In this episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, we'll be getting down with the nines, ripping some threads, RTX 2080s, NV-linked, lovely Lenovos, and Amiga Alive next. Welcome back to another episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, and you'll have to excuse my Barry White-esque tone in my throat. I have a bit of a cold, but I'm not asking for your sympathy. I'm appreciating your viewership though, and I'm Dave Altavilla, and I have with me my favorite geek friend, Marco Cipetta, and that's all I have is one geek friend today. I just have this guy. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing okay. I'm happy it's Friday. Looking forward to the weekend. We have some cool stuff to talk about, so I'm in a good mood.
You got your Taka shirt on there. Talk about curing autism. Very important topic.
I do have my Taka shirt on. Wifey just brought this home from the national conference, so figured I'd sport
it. Excellent. And fine, arrest me red color, too. I like that. Good stuff.
And look at me red.
Well, that's all right. Better than looking at you than me and my partially recovered. I had a massive head cold for the past week, and I am now just getting over it. And we are sans Chris or Paulie today, but we're going to kick it around because we've got a lot going on. There's been a lot launching in the last couple of weeks in the land of tech. Lots of new technology, good stuff. Are you caught up now? Are you catching your breath a little bit? Because you went on, like, no joke, I don't know, maybe a week and a half worth of rapid fire launch articles. You were writing many words.
I thought I was caught up. I've made some progress cleaning the disaster that is my office. But of course I leave for an event Monday, and over this past week, three launches fell in my lap that all happened within the week after I get back. So I'm still screwed. Haven't been able to build myself a new rig like I want to yet, but I'll get it done.
What are you going to build when you do get a chance to build that new rig?
A Threadripper with a Radeon Pro WX card.
Very nice. Many cores and professional stable graphics. I get you. Well, that's good, because when you got a work machine, it's gotta execute and it can't fail. And when you're playing with a lot of things like Photoshop and video editing and all kinds of stuff like that. So maybe the Pro Graphics GPU is the way to go. And God knows. Wait, how many core Threadripper are you looking to do? 16 or 32 or 24? What do you got?
I'm going to do the 2990 WX. I'm going to do the 32 core because dynamic local mode makes it. I want to see how that progresses over time when you're actually using it. So I'm going to do a Threadripper workstation processor with workstation graphics. Hopefully that a little bit of extra validation on the software keeps things nice and stable with Optane storage, plenty of memory. It's not going to be a meager system.
No, I guess not. You're gonna be fighting to tax that thing. Excellent. Sounds good. And you're gonna have to, when you get there someday, you're gonna have to show us all how you do it, right? With your immaculate.
Oh no, it's going on video. We'll feature it on the channel.
Nice. Excellent. Glad to hear that. Hey, well, if you're in the chat, and there's only a few of you so far, but we're waiting. Come on, come out of the woodwork now. Fire away with your questions. And we'll keep an eye on that and try and get to them. But let's dive into the headlines that Marco has been toiling over lately. And we'll cover the reviews and a few other things that have gone on this week. But let's talk about Intel's Core i9-9900K CPU. There's a lot of nines going on there. If you like nines, this CPU is you, man. 8-core, Coffee Lake. Jacked up on some serious clock speed. What do you know there, buddy?
We know a lot. This processor had been leaking for months. You know, we kind of knew it was coming, but it's finally arrived. This is actually a new piece of silicon. It is a true 8-core Coffee Lake, and it actually has some hardware updates to mitigate the Spectre meltdown and some of those flaws. Not all of them, but this is a new chip. Its claim to fame is a 5 gigahertz boost clock. Now, and unlike the 8086K, which had trouble boosting to five gigahertz because it was only a single thread boost. And if there was other stuff happening in Windows, it didn't always boost that high. This chip will hit 5 gigahertz. And with good cooling, you can overclock all cores to 5 gigahertz fairly easily. But yeah, so this is a monster of a chip. Not only do you have, let me back up, just do some quick specs. So yes, 8-core with hyper-threading. So 8 cores, 16 threads, base clock of 3.6 gigahertz, turbo boost clock of 5 gigahertz, that magic 5 gigahertz number, 16 megs of smart cache in there, up to 40 lanes on the platform of PCI Express. The chip sells for $488, so it's kind of on the pricey side for Intel's mainstream platform. This is anything but a mainstream processor. But performance is killer. So you have Intel's latest cores with more cache, higher clocks. The Intel also introduced a new chipset to go along with this, the Z390. Now, Z390 is very similar to Z370, but it adds native support for USB 3.1 Gen 2 and a built-in wireless controller. And what most motherboard partners did was also tweak the power delivery to make sure these ninth gen processors are fed plenty of power. We tested on a beautiful Gigabyte Z390 board, and the combination of Z390 and 9900K is easily the fastest platform for single threaded or lightly threaded apps, because you have Intel's latest cores. Intel has an IPC advantage over AMD, clocked at the highest clocks that they've been able to pull off over sustained workloads. And so you end up with the fastest platform for lightly threaded workloads, which is important for just tooling around on your desktop, browsing, what have you, and also a really fast processor for multi-threaded workloads. Doesn't quite catch an Intel 10-core 7900X, but it's right behind it. Even though it has two fewer cores, it boosts to a higher clock. So it's really just behind a Core i9-7900X. And just a really, I really enjoyed working with this processor. The experience on a PC powered by 9900K is really, really good.
Okay. So 5 gigahertz max turbo boost. How many threads do you get at 5 gigahertz, or how many cores do you boost? Just one?
Two.
How many do you get?
Two.
Two. So boosts two well, no, out no, of two, the
two,
eight.
Two thread boost. It's single core boost, but two threads.
Got it. Got it. So yeah. Well, so single core with hyper threading. What about when you're like, what's max boost when on all cores?
So I actually have a screenshot in there. So all cores under load actually measured, like I actually measured, it was 4.5 gigahertz. Intel says up to 4.7, and it will tick to 4.7, or maybe it was 4.6, but most of the time when it's heated up and under load, it'll do 4.5 all cores.
Yeah. That should be pretty freaking snappy, I would say. 8-core, 16 threads at 4.5 gigahertz. That's that is a robust setup. What were thermals like with that thing? Is Intel pushing the envelope here? Are we seeing sort of the max end of the architecture? Are we maxing that out?
Intel is absolutely pushing the envelope here and kind of wringing all they can from their 14 nanometer process. So stock. Now, I tested with a decent but mainstream all-in-one liquid cooler. So I tested with a Corsair H80i all-in-one liquid cooler. It's not a super high-end cooler, but it's not crap by any means either. So good mainstream cooler, just to give everyone sort of a real world scenario, if you haven't sprung for an insane cooler, what you can expect. Now, out of the box, if you're not overclocking, thermals are okay. This is a very thermally dense chip. Intel did switch to a solder TIM to help thermals get out of the chip and through that heat spreader better than the regular paste that they've been using for the last few years. But so stock, I typically saw really quickly under load, it'll shoot into the, you know, mid 80s, low 80s under load with a cooler like the one I used, which is perfectly fine. It's not cool, but it's fine. It's not going to throttle. You're good. However, soon as you start to push it and try to overclock, it really, you have to have a great cooler to manage the thermals. Like literally when I just tried to overclock all cores to 5 gigahertz, so not pushing past 5 gigahertz, but just all cores to 5 gigahertz, the moment you start a multi-threaded workload like Cinebench, thermals are in the high 90s and it throttled with the cooler that I used. So it's not that it was unstable, but you don't get that killer performance boost that you'd expect. Now, if you put awesome cooling on there, that's going to be crazy fast. Now, with the setup that I had, I found the best balanced performance. I might mix up the exact number of cores. Let me just double check. Okay, so I did a 51x multiplier on 3 cores. So 5.1 on 3 cores, 5 gigahertz on 3 cores, and 4.9 gigahertz on the remaining 2. And with that, with the setup I had at about 1.3 volts, I just tickled that throttle limit. If I really hammered on it, it would throttle, but I was still getting better performance than stock. So yeah, it's Intel's definitely on the edge of what 14 nanometer can do with this chip. But if you play with it and you have great cooling, really nice platform.
Gotcha. Hey, John, I just sent you a link in the chat. Here's an idea if you want to take a look at it for cooling for the 9900K. This is Corsair's H100i. They now have H100i RGB Platinum, actually. John, in the chat, if you look, I sent you a link there. I don't know if you can put that up, but basically there's the kind of cooler you're probably going to want for a 9900K, right, Marco? That is a double 120 millimeter fan cooler. That is a serious setup there. Certainly you've got your RGB lighting bling going on. I just took a quick look at that this week. I'm going to be actually building a rig with it myself, and I'm planning to drop in maybe something with 18 or 16 cores. We'll see. But yeah, that's probably a little bit better for the setup you're talking about with the 9900K, right?
Oh yeah, that's definitely going to outperform the cooler I had. The one I had, it's a single, it's a 120 millimeter radiator, so that radiator is twice the size.
Yeah. So this chip needs some cooling, but serious performance if you can keep it from hitting thermal saturation on your cooling solution. What do you think about the 9900K versus 2700X from the folks at AMD?
If you just look at performance, Intel basically wins across the board. It's faster single thread, faster multi-thread. The kicker, though, is the Intel chip's much more expensive. Like you can find deals on Ryzen combos where you can literally get the Ryzen chip, a Ryzen 2700X, and a motherboard and still have hundreds left over. Versus just the $500 or roughly $500 Intel's asking for the 9900K. So in terms of the straight value prop, there's a premium for the 9900K, no doubt. But I mean, it really is the fastest chip overall for gaming, and it will offer one of the best computing experiences if you like a snappy, low latency system. You're going to pay a little bit of a premium for it.
That's
the name of the game.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where it's a trade-off in architecture, right? For the folks at AMD, they can scale number of cores by stacking up additional dies inside of a Ryzen chip, and number of CCXs, core complexes. With Intel, a little bit pricier in terms of the fact that they're a pure monolithic die to get those 8 cores. Do you think Intel is commanding a premium still, or is it just architecture cost trade-offs between the two? I mean, AMD obviously is able to hit some pretty aggressive price points for an 8-core.
Yeah, I mean, the 9900K and the 2700X are both native 8 cores. So it's not that, and the regular Ryzen, it's only a single die. So where Ryzen doesn't quite catch Intel is IPC is a little lower and their clocks aren't quite as high.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the chip itself is something like $200 cheaper. So that's a big savings. You know, it was something like a 60% difference. I don't remember the exact numbers, but yeah, it's not an insignificant difference in price. It's certainly not commensurate with the performance difference. You know, the 9900K is not 60% faster. It's faster, but not 60% faster to command that kind of a premium. But people always will pay a little extra for, you know, the king of the hill, and the 9900K for gamers is the king of the hill right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If we look at Cinebench, the 9900K is, you know, looks like, I don't know, what, maybe 10 to 15% faster than a 2700X?
Yeah.
Yeah, just looking at Cinebench, you know, when you get to, you know, heavily threaded stuff, Pavre, which again is a heavily threaded benchmark, sort of the same thing, a little bit more leg room there for the 9900K. But good stuff from Intel in the mainstream space, the Z390 platform where folks live in that, you know, 4, 8, 6 core socket area. But Marco, you also have been playing around with some AMD sockets that take many more cores. And the folks at AMD came out with the Ryzen Threadripper 2920X and the 2970WX. These are lower cost, many core beasts, as you describe them, from the folks at AMD. So dropping in at 12 cores and 24 cores respectively, getting, I guess, flushing out that that product stack a little bit between the 16 and 32 core. What did you think of those?
Very, very interesting, but very different chips. So yeah, when Threadripper second gen launched, you had the 2990WX, the full fat 32 core, 64 thread monster. And then you had the 16 core 2950X. These are the little brothers. You just disable one core per CCX and you end up with the 12 core 2920X and the 24 core 2970WX. So let me just get the specs out of the way first, and then I'm going to really summarize the 2920 quickly because I really like that chip. So 2920X, 180-watt TDP. This is for the Threadripper TR4 socket, so AMD's X399 platform. 12 cores, 24 threads, 16 megs per die of L3 cache, so 32 megs of cache on the 2920. Base frequency, now pay attention to these because they're very different for the two chips. Base clock, 3.5 gigahertz. Boost clock of 4.3 gigahertz, quad channel memory, and then basically all the features the same as second gen Ryzen. They're all using the same die. That's a $649 chip, which it sounds like a lot, but to get into the Threadripper platform, that's actually the least expensive chip. Now let's go to the crazy big boy, 2970WX, 250-watt TDP for just the CPU, 24 cores, 48 threads, total of 64 megs of L3 cache, so tons of cache. Now, base clock much lower, 3 gigahertz base clock, boost clock of 4.2, so only 100 megahertz lower. And then again, all the same features in terms of architecture because it's all the same die across every Ryzen second gen. That's $1,299. Now, that's also a pricey chip, but way cheaper than for that many cores than anything Intel has to offer. Okay, now performance all over the map. 2920 I really like because it's less thermally dense, right, than all the other Ryzens. Not all the other Ryzens, it's less thermally dense than the full 8-core Threadrippers, you know, that have all 8 cores activated per die, so it can maintain boost clocks basically a little bit longer than the other chips. So what you end up with the 2920 is some of the best single threaded from any AMD Ryzen processor with really good multi-thread performance, right? So you got nice high clocks, 24 threads, nothing to sneeze at. So you're not going to compete with the crazy high-end chips that have 64 threads, but 24 threads for $650, get really strong multi-threaded performance with the lowest price possible to get into AMD's high-end desktop platform. I like that combination. I think that's a good combo. If you want to jump into a really high-end platform and, you know, maybe have some room for expandability in the future, 2920 is a great chip. Good all-around chip, does everything well. Okay. Should I go on or do questions?
Well, I'm looking at the 2920 and I'm actually just pulling up some multi-thread performance. And if we look at things like Cinebench and again, Pavre, you know, these are tests that really tax the CPU 100% over all of its available threads. You're looking at a 2920, 30% faster than a 9900K on average, if I'm doing my math right. That's impressive. You're talking $649 for that chip, for the 2920, and 488, just under $500 for the 9900K. So it's a little bit more pricey. It's $150 or thereabouts more expensive. You get four more cores and a chunk more performance. So yeah, that's I don't know, that is a compelling solution in price point, I think.
I agree. For someone that wants to play at the high end, it's very interesting. Yeah. Now the 2970WX, right?
Yeah.
So these many core Threadrippers were all four die or active. If you go back to our original launch piece, I explained a little bit in this piece. I don't rehash the whole thing, but two of the dies don't have memory attached. So that means if a workload spills over to one of those that AMD calls them compute dies, there's much more latency getting data on and off those dies because it has to go from one die to another, then out to memory. And that can negatively affect performance in some workloads. Yeah. It happens in quite a few, but now what's changed since the original launch, I think it was in August, is AMD came out with something called dynamic local mode that they've added to Ryzen Master. Dynamic local mode will analyze a workload and automatically schedule workloads that benefit from local memory to the dies that have the local memory attached. So if you have a huge, you know, multi-threaded workload like Cinebench where latency doesn't matter, it's unaffected, it just runs on all the cores. But if you have something more lightly threaded and it's spilled over to one of those compute dies and it doesn't have local memory and performance isn't great, it'll get scheduled back, it'll get pushed back to the local dies. That theoretically fixes any of the weird performance issues. So because there's all these different modes, I tested all three, right, available with that processor. I tested out of the box, no tweaks, so all 24 cores enabled. I tested all 24 cores enabled with dynamic local mode turned on. And then I tested in legacy compatibility mode with half cores. So it essentially keeps all the workloads on the local dies that have memory attached. So you mitigate any of those latency issues at the expense of having total compute.
Right.
And as you'd expect, performance is kind of everywhere. So multi-threaded stuff, it's a monster. It's an absolute beast. Second fastest processor out there, only behind the 2990WX, only behind its big brother. Single thread, not quite as fast as other AMD chips because it's clocked a little lower and does not compete with Intel, Intel's latest cores. Just Intel just has an advantage there. Dynamic local mode helped in many instances. I found one bug in Shadow of War where it actually hurt performance. It was repeatable. It's not supposed to do that, but it did. So very specialized chip. Now, if you go to half core mode, though, you get rid of all those issues, but then you lose some of that multi-thread performance. Now, it's cool that AMD gives you the option to just flip a switch and do that in a piece of software. I suspect most people going with a chip like this aren't going to want to do it often, but you can if you have to. So for multi-threaded folks, content creators that need those, you know, immense number of cores, $500 cheaper than the 2990WX and the second fastest multi-threaded processor you can get, for, you know, almost $1,000 cheaper than you can get a 7980XE, something like $900 cheaper. So not cheap, but a crazy fast chip if you work in multi-threaded land.
Gotcha. Marco, you stuttered for a minute. I'm not sure if that is going to show up on the cast, but I'm not sure if that was us or you. But anyways, yeah, no, it's an interesting look at performance. And I threw a couple of links in the chat for John to scan through if he can pull them up. These are not, you know, I should say the higher end 2970, you know, the WX chips are not for the mainstream consumer unless you are doing a lot of content creation on your own. And that's not really a consumer use case. Because, you know, you really have to tax all those cores simultaneously to get the best bang, you know, for your buck out of those things, right? I mean, that's kind of the moral of the story. If you're a gamer, you know, the 12 core or the 16 core makes a little bit more sense. And if you look at some of the gaming benchmarks, you know, these many core architectures, you know, you're largely wasting all of those core resources in most game engines. You know, if you're around four to eight cores, six to eight cores, what have you, with hyper-threading or simultaneous multi-threading, You're kind of in the sweet spot for gamers, for gaming, you know, when coupled with high clock speed. But if you're a content creation professional, I think what we're looking at here, when you look at things like Poverty and Cinebench, when you're breaking 4K in Cinebench, that's some pretty good content creation horsepower, Marco, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's if you're not going to tax the cores, you're just wasting money going with something like this. So definitely not for the mainstream user. A 2920X would be way more than enough for most people, for the vast majority of people. The workstation chips, absolutely really geared towards content creation professionals and professionals that will leverage all of that horsepower. Or, I mean, the one kicker, so lots of streamers, what everyone likes to call megatasking now, everyone forgets that there's lots of confusion with many core chips that, oh, if you're not running a multi-threaded app, there's no point. But you got to remember, every thread in the background on Windows, I mean, sorry, every process in the background on Windows is a thread. And if you have some apps that are lightly threaded, you can hit all of the cores, maybe not with a sustained workload, but having those extra core resources means less stutter and more multitasking capability. So if you're streaming and, you know, streaming a game, let's say, you can be gaming and streaming all on one system and not really have any hiccups or stutters. You have such immense horsepower there. Some people use two systems to pull stuff like that off. But yeah, again, it's not really, it's not a mainstream platform. It is a high-end workstation platform for sure.
Yeah, I would argue the pro streamer or even the casual streamer that's, you know, gaming, streaming, you know, running, you know, a chat window, you know, with a mic over it and, you know, mixing in multiple different you know, streams of content into a window and broadcasting it. That is a content creation workflow technically. And we actually did that. Chris Getting and I actually did a stream one time where we took Threadripper, the 16 core first gen Threadripper at the time, and we tried to load that thing down as much as we could. We were rendering video in the background while we were gaming with PUBG at 4K, while streaming and capturing that stream. And yeah, it was amazing how we actually pushed that machine. Those 16 cores were working hard. You know, the fans were spinning up and it was pumping heat out the back. We had an Alienware Area 51 version machine at the time, just chugging away. But I can tell you that we could do everything we wanted to all at the same time. And it was a beautiful thing. But that's the kind of thing you need to do to justify a chip that approaches $1,000 and has, you know, 12 or 16 cores. The 12 core maybe is a little bit more reasonable at $649, right?
Yeah, so definitely. I could easily justify or talk people into that 2920 X. I think that's, I hesitate to say a good value, but it's such a great platform to get into, nice and mature and so much expandability. And you'd have such immense horsepower without insane heat, without insane power consumption. That's a fun platform for me.
Yeah. AMD and Intel doing some fun things these days. It's nice to have them competing against each other for market share in the enthusiast computing space. It certainly creates a dynamic of, more vigorous product launches. We've seen it. You and I are busy as heck, flying all over the country, meeting these people with briefings for their new products. And it's never a dull moment for us, but it's certainly a lot to choose from for the consumer, especially as we approach the holiday season. So good stuff, good selection. And Chris,
and who doesn't want a chip that's like the size of a cell phone?
Yeah, baby, you could fry an egg on that. If you didn't have the cooler on, you could literally crack an egg and fry it while it's running.
Now they don't get that hot unless you're whaling on them. But look at the size of that thing.
It is a monster. Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff from the folks at AMD, and welcome Chris Getting to the chat. Good to have you with us, brother. It's been a while. We would like to have you back on again soon. But Chris is working away right now in the middle of the day on a Friday. So let's move on to another, I guess, question of value proposition and performance, and what are the benefits and the trade-offs between those two dynamics. NVIDIA GeForce RTX 2080 Ti, NVLink, SLI scaling explored by our good friend Shannon Robert, who has joined the Hot Hardware fray to freelance some of his computing knowledge for our audience. And yeah, so there you go. You got a pair of 2080 Ti's. That's what, I don't know, $2,400 worth of GPU horsepower there that we're strapping together, in SLI over the new NVLink bridge. What can we tell these folks, Marco? Let's kick that off. I'll dive in with you. But an interesting study. Scaling is it looks good in some spots and kind of weird in other spots, right?
Well, so there's still some, I'm not going to say confusion, but misunderstandings about NVLink. So NVLink, the new connector, the new bridge, I should say, that connects GeForce RTX cards, is way more advanced and offers much more bandwidth than the SLI connectors from Pascal. I think Pascal peaked with a high bandwidth bridge at something like 4 gigs a second. NVLink on 2080 Ti's can do 100 gigs a second. It can do 50 gigs a second on the 2080s. And in addition to being a display link, it also allows some communications to the memory, the frame buffers, the memory on each card. So that's going to enable some new possibilities. And all that bandwidth is going to enable some different, potentially, multi-GPU modes. But as it stands today, really nothing has changed because none of the software is can do, you know, can take advantage of what NVLink offers. But if you're interested in seeing how SLI performs on two 2080 Ti's, you know, NVLink is it. So we compared two cards linked together versus the high-end 1080 Ti's linked together in SLI with a high bandwidth bridge. And what you see is sort of what you expect to see, because those NVLink advantages aren't being taken care of. In CPU-bound circumstances, scaling is perhaps not quite as good because the RTX cards are waiting around longer. The 1080 Ti's don't offer nearly as much performance. So they're waiting around. There's less of a CPU limit. But when the GPUs are completely bottlenecked and you're at high res with some of the latest titles with all the image quality cranked up, you get a little better scaling on the new cards and they're allowed to stretch their legs a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the moral of the story. If you're at all thinking about running a pair of 2080 Ti's in SLI over this NVLink connection, you better be ready to run 4K, because otherwise you're wasting a whole lot of money, right?
You just don't need it. You know, so a multi-monitor setup or 4K minimum.
Yeah. I wonder, we have to take a look at what a pair of 2080s would look like. It's too bad 2070s don't have the NVLink connector on them, but 2080s might be an interesting view to see as well. What do you think about, I mean, obviously, as you noted, NVLink, we're not really taxing the bandwidth in current game implementations. What do you think about the future of multi-GPU as it relates to DX12 with this architecture and, you know, moving forward with certainly with AMDs? Are we going to get back to the point where we're actually where multi-GPU is, you know, a more significant percentage of market share? Because right now, I don't think it is. I just don't think folks are running that many SLI setups, maybe on the lower end, you know, like 1060 or whatever. But
I don't think so, because with DX12, developers have to code the discrete multi-GPU support on their own. It doesn't just work like it used to. You're just not going to get every developer that does it. You're going to get those premium titles, those showcase titles where NVIDIA and AMD work with the developers to showcase the hardware, where things are going to be pretty great. But the days of slapping in a second video card and, you know, increasing your performance by 80 to 100% with everything you ran are gone. And I don't think they're coming back anytime soon.
Yeah. Shannon just joined the chat, the author of this article. Good to have you with us, Shannon. And he echoed your sentiment exactly and said what Marco said. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what NVIDIA does with NVLink, because I think when you talk about things like tensor cores and ray tracing engines, there you could see perhaps it's complex now, but there you could see perhaps chaining two GPUs together for more performance in those types of applications. Maybe I don't know how that affects it moving forward. We haven't been briefed, or NVIDIA hasn't discussed that with us, but I'm sort of, you know, marinating on that. What do you think? Is that a possibility in the future? It would make sense to me that, you know, ganging up your ray tracing engines and your tensor cores might be a benefit.
Yeah, I mean, you in compute workloads now, you see really good scaling.
You do.
It's the games where, you know, they may not be coded well. You know, it used to be, before there was all these deferred rendering techniques and different AA techniques, you can either just do a split frame or alternate frame rendering, and bang, you had better performance. It just doesn't work like that anymore, because the game engines are very different animals. So without the specific coding for games, you're just not going to see it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it is what it is. Plus, it's always, you know, it's always better, in my opinion, instead of going for two. Now, if you have the funds for two of the best cards, fantastic. You know, we all hate you, but good for you. But if always better to spring for a single high-end card versus pairing together two lower-end cards. You just eliminate so many variables, and there's just less issues with stutter and game compatibility. So it's just something to consider.
Yeah. I'll be interested to watch what NVIDIA does, and AMD, when they come out with their next gen, but what NVIDIA does with NVLink in the future, and how they utilize that, because it would seem to me that they wouldn't have made the move to that new connector style sort of spent the engineering resources to validate that, prove it out, get it into the architecture, if they weren't going to tap it in the future significantly. And so I think when you talk about ray tracing and other, you know, maybe it's DLSS, you know, with tensor cores, I think that's where the future lies for that, versus just traditional AFR or what have you, you know, SLI frame rendering on that thing. We'll have to watch in the weeks ahead, the months ahead, as we roll into CES. We've already been notified by the folks at NVIDIA that they're having a little something out there, and lots of folks are going to be having a little something out in Las Vegas in January. So stay tuned. Hey, let's move on to and you got to look at this too, Marco. Let's move on to the land of mobile and talk about Lenovo's Yoga C930, which, you know, when I first got a look at this machine, I thought, oh, it's another nice Svelte, you know, Lenovo machine. They make some really nice hybrid 2-in-1 convertibles. And there it is there. Good looking machine. All machined aluminum, chamfered edges, really sharp lines, really, really sleek looking machine. And of course, the 360-degree swing Yoga hinge. So you converts into tablet mode. And as a 13-inch tablet, it's a little unwieldy. That's actually, I take that back. It's 13.9 inches, or roughly a 14-inch device. It has a really cool a stylus pen holster in the back, sort of spring-loaded. And when you plug it in there, automatically charges. So stylus pen enabled as well, with a touchscreen. That is a 1080p HDR touch display, by the way. Actually beautiful. Nice thin bezels, as you can see as I'm sort of hand modeling it there. So really nice display, 1080p touch with a stylus, and all machined aluminum and backlit keyboard. You know, just looks great. Chiclet style keys, not the Lenovo ThinkPad style workhorse keyboard that we're used to. Key travels a little bit on the shallow side, I'll be honest. But if you're used to, you know, banging on chiclets, like, you know, 80% of the laptop designs out there these days, certainly competitive with, you know, things like, you know, Dell's XPS line and MacBook Air and all that. They're all chiclets. So I think it's right there. But what makes this laptop really stand out, and what surprised the heck out of me, was its audio solution. And it has... John, I don't know if you can pull up another picture of a close up of the sound bar. There's this Dolby Atmos sound bar in the middle of the hinge. So that 360-degree swing hinge has a chamber that's perforated aluminum, There you go. Nice good look at it right there. Perfect. So that's the Dolby Atmos soundbar. That perforated chamber is on both sides of the hinge, and in there are larger drivers and a whole, you know, acoustic resonance chamber, if you will, that really does a nice job of providing much better spatialization, you know, stereo effect, really nice open sound. So really great mids for movie watching, what have you, audio tracks, you know, speaking, and then actually satisfying bass response. Like, I couldn't believe out of this 3-pound machine that I was getting actually decent bass response. And so I did a quick little video review, and Chris Ledekin wrote it up for us. This machine actually, I'm sorry, it was Tuan that wrote this up. This machine actually impressed me from a standpoint of its audio solution. When you think about a 3-pound laptop, you expect almost nothing. It's like, you know, tin pop, thin sound and stuff you get from 90% of the laptops out there. This machine actually, you would flip it on your kitchen counter and let it pipe Pandora and not be annoyed by how thin it sounds. It actually sounds pretty good. So I don't know if you got a chance to poke at that, Marco, but I was impressed with Lenovo. It's a beautiful machine.
I agree. So if you haven't checked out the review, or if you haven't been by the site, after we're done with the podcast, check the channel, because Dave produced a really great video of this machine. And all around, I think it's awesome. So I think it's a good-looking machine. Lenovo, they didn't go as thin as possible. It's a little thicker, but they sort of did some visual trickery with the edges to make it look thin, but they kept a nice big battery in there. It's not an OLED display, but it's a really awesome Dolby Vision IPS display, high-quality panel. And the audio is great. And the machine just looks good, in my opinion. It personally, I love this machine. It's not super pricey for what you get. So it was like $12.99, the configuration we tested. I think that it was a Best Buy exclusive, this particular model. But, you know, a Core i7 8th gen with 12 gigs of RAM, a fast SSD, that killer audio, killer screen, good looks. That machine's a winner, in my opinion. That thing's nice.
Yeah. 3 pounds. And it has sort of all the right configurations. It's got two USB-C Thunderbolt ports and a standard USB 3 port headset jack. Missing an SD card slot. I will say I wish that was in there, even if it was a micro SD card slot somewhere. So that's the shortcoming there. Battery life was solid. I think it put up something like a little over 7.5 hours or thereabouts battery life. So it was in the top quadrant, I would say 25% of all the laptops we've tested in its weight class with a 1080p display. This has a 1080p HDR display, not the brightest, but bright enough, 300 nits display. But the colors and the saturation, the contrast and the pop on it were excellent because it's an HDR display. So it's Dolby Vision HDR plus Dolby Atmos plus the Pen Stylus you're seeing right there as I'm fumbling around in Windows Ink. But really impressive. And for $12.99, I think, you know, if you get the there you go, JBJ's home run coming up, baby. I think that was a 3-run shot from from the playoffs before the World Series when Boston took the whole thing, baby. Yeah, all right. I won't get too excited here. I had to work that into the video review. But for $12.99, it's a whole lot of beautiful machine. I believe they do have a 4K panel version for a little bit more money. I think 1080p in this format is just fine. I'd love to see a 1440p option if that's available. I think that's sort of my sweet spot. I think a lot of folks would be fine with 1080 though. Got to hand it to Lenovo. That is a fantastic machine with, great performance, good battery life, and, you know, like, sound that you're not gonna cringe when you flip it on. I mean, how many times do you flip on an ultrabook and it's like, okay, let's play some music? No, please put on a Bluetooth speaker. You're hurting my ears. You just don't see it often. You don't hear it often. So this is they actually managed to do it, and they managed to do it within a reasonable price point. So the folks at Lenovo with the Yoga C930. So this is on your wish list, Marco. You wouldn't mind getting this for Christmas? Excuse me.
I wouldn't mind getting it for Christmas, but I'm the lucky owner of a rose gold and spun white XPS 13 with a little bit better specs than this machine. So I don't think I'd put that down.
That's no slouch either. The Dell yeah. XPS 13. Yeah, I know you did like that one. That's a good one too. You know, it's really great to see the folks at Dell, Lenovo, HP really going at it these days. I mean, the laptop designs that are coming out, and there's some pretty great stuff coming from HP too, the Spectre line. Really just impressive notebook designs now with quad cores in them, in some cases six cores. So you're getting a lot of horsepower. You did a little study, and I'll throw a little plug out there. One thing you got to look out for, though, with these machines, Marco did a little study on this. We actually did our research company. We actually have an analyst firm now called Hot Tech Vision and Analysis, hottech.com. Check it out. Marco did a little white paper we put together on thermal saturation over time, performance of mainstream notebooks over time as they hit thermal saturation. You know, how does your laptop hold up under sustained use, which is the average mainstream workload, use case, I should say, for users? Do you just burst, a video render, or do you just burst, streaming a video? No, you'll sit there for minutes and hours on end doing a task that might be stressing your quad core CPU in a notebook. Each thin and light notebook has, a thermal envelope that it can withstand before it starts bleeding off performance. And we actually did a very in-depth study, and you should check that out if you want to hit hottech.com. You'll see a study commissioned by Dell, actually, to take a look at it. And we looked at anything from the Microsoft Surface to Dell to HP to Lenovo, and you'll be surprised. So that's one thing to look at. Make sure you're checking the independent reviews of laptops and look for comments about how the machine holds up in terms of thermal performance. Right, Marco?
Yeah. What most people will find is if you run, let's say Cinebench, because that's the data that we published in that paper, you'll run it once and you'll get expected strong performance. But if you run it 10 times in a row, you might see one machine that has a robust thermal solution and a properly tuned power profile maybe bleed off max 2 to 4%, 5% performance. Whereas a thinner, lighter machine, perhaps one that doesn't have a properly tuned power profile or, a lighter duty cooler might lose 15, 20% of its performance. So that's a significant jump and that's noticeable. That's depending on what kind of work you do on your machine. If you're just browsing around and working in Word and Outlook, maybe it's less of a concern. But if you're going to be on the road and you have to crunch video while you're writing an article while resizing images,
yeah,
then it's a concern. You can slow the machine to a halt if it throttles. So yes, it might even change the way people evaluate notebooks once people fully digest this kind of information.
Yeah. Good call. And I think that's something, in terms of our flow at Hot Hardware, we need to start adding to notebook evaluation. How much did it throttle? What percentage variance did we see overextended use? And so if you get that nice Cinebench bar chart that shows you performance of a bunch of notebooks in the same class and the notebook, the subject notebook of a review, for example. Okay, you've got that number. Great. Okay, then that's a fast notebook. It drops in here in the depth chart with all the others in its class. Now, okay, how much does it vary overextended use? And if that's 5%, okay. If it's 10%, maybe not so okay. Maybe that's a little bit of a ding for that thermal solution that was put together by the OEM. So it's interesting. And I think we are going to start incorporating that. But if you want to get a taste of that, head over to hottech.com. I just threw a link in the chat. Check that out. I think it's an important topic that some folks in our industry certainly have begun to talk about. I think Dave Lee, one of the YouTubers that's very popular out there, he's looked at that in spots for sure. Good guy, by the way. Dave 2D. I'm sure you guys know him. Shout out to Dave. I like his work. So good stuff. And the Yoga C930, we'll have to look at that too, see how that holds up. But I think it has an all aluminum design. So it sort of has a wicking sort of mechanism about it already. I'm going to cough, excuse me. Still getting over cold. And I think that actually holds up pretty well thermally when I was testing it, but I know Tuan put it through its paces as well. Thanks, Tuan. Good job on that review. Let's move along. Let's close out on something of a very happy place for Marco. It's alive. Commodore's Amiga reborn again as Vampire V4 standalone boots for the first time. So you mean to tell me that little board is an entire Amiga computer from yesteryear and now it's renewed?
It depends who you ask, right? So obviously it's not a Commodore or S, Amiga. It's not a physical machine, but just to give a little background, the Apollo team makes these Vampire accelerators. There's lots of accelerators for these old Amigas. There's still a huge vibrant community around the Amiga. And these accelerators took the old machines that say maybe had just a plain old 68000 processor, and they, you know, featured a faster 68020 or 030 or maybe an 060, you know, higher end processor that allowed for much faster performance, you know, relatively speaking, of course, and maybe access to more memory and faster memory. So like the demo scene, for example, if you wanted to run some of those, you know, really bleeding edge demos on an Amiga, a stock machine couldn't do it. You needed an accelerator to pull it off. Now, the Apollo team, these Vampire accelerator boards, you can add them into, I believe, a currently available or released, the V2s were for the 500 and the 600, Amiga 500, Amiga 600. Mm. And, you know, what the Apollo team has done is they've taken an FPGA and they've recreated the capabilities of a Motorola core. They call their CPU core inside the FPGA an 080 because it's more advanced than an 060, even though it's not an ASIC, but the capabilities are there. And they've systematically recreated the chipset, all of those custom chips that were in the Amiga, also in the FPGA. Now, the previous gen boards, they ran out of gates in the FPGA, so they are working on these newer Vampires, the V4s, and not only have they recreated the AGA chipset, the newer chipset that was in the Amiga 1200, they've added some capabilities, and these aren't released yet, right? But the accelerator boards, they've been shown many times, added into an Amiga. I've seen it live in person at some local user group meetings. The Vampire V4 as an accelerator has been functioning, and it's working, and it's doing things that other accelerators can't do because they've recreated the chipset in there. When they were announced, a standalone version was also mentioned because all the chips are recreated, and this little board has all the I.O. it needs. Technically, you don't need an Amiga to accelerate. You could just run everything on the FPGA. It just hadn't been working yet. But Pedro Cotter of the Apollo team, just the other day, showed the first video demo of the standalone machine booting. So what you essentially have is the first modern updated 68K compatible Amiga in decades. Now, there have been other FPGAs, but they're really just using the VHDL files to recreate an Amiga. This one adds capabilities, way better performance than any actual Amiga, and it booted for the first time. So some of the Amiga purists, they hate this kind of idea, but some of the guys that love the platform and love to see new stuff get released for it and see it advance, you know, 30 years later, are really psyched. So I just love seeing this stuff because the Amiga holds a special place in my heart. So I thought it was really cool to see.
So it's a fascinating thing to me. There's an entire community out there of serious engineers that are digging back into the history books and breathing new life into this beloved Commodore platform, Commodore computer from years ago before, you know, everybody had a PC in their house. And maybe as a kid, it was your first PC if your parents were, you know, astute enough to get one. You know, I mean, that's not something that the average household had. But these are major league engineers that work in at companies. You know, they have full time jobs and they're doing this out of the love of the platform, huh?
Yeah. So the V4 has been in development for 2 years. Like, the stuff does not come out quickly for the platform. And I forget which team member on the Apollo team, but he actually works for Huawei making the Kirin processors in the Huawei phones.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's basically just a group of dedicated guys doing this in their spare time. And yeah, they basically systematically recreated the functionality of an Amiga in an FPGA. Now, pie in the sky stuff, I've had conversations with some of the guys. Technically, once the FPGA is done and the firmwares are done and everything's working, they could make an ASIC. And now you can have an Amiga on a chip, and who knows what that means.
Right.
Obviously, costs would go way down. There would be that initial investment for the wafer start and getting all of that, you know, all the lithography done. But it would make for basically a cheap one-chip Amiga if somebody wanted to build something like that. I got to back up a little further. Just like the last few weeks, there was an OS update. You know, Amiga OS 3.1.4 just came out. So there's still updates happening.
Wow.
It's amazing. Like it's still primitive versus obviously everything we have now, but there's still stuff happening, and there's still infighting over the companies that own the patents. So it holds a lot of this stuff up, believe it or not, still all these years later. But it's just such a fun soap opera and some cool stuff to see for me. Because, like I said, I love the Amiga.
You know, I wonder, you know, in that case where they spun it to an ASIC, let's say somebody actually spent the money for a mask set. I mean, and that's no joke. I mean, I don't know what, you know, process node you're talking about. Maybe you could get something like that in, like, you know, 22 nanometer or something workhorse that wouldn't be so expensive. 22 isn't even that, you know, maybe it's more like 28 or 30. But anyways, you know, if you got to that and you were able to produce this thing for, I don't know, what, 35, 40 bucks, could you envision like a Nintendo NES freaking free for all where these things are selling on the internet and people are buying them up just to geek out and, you know, relive their retro computing yesteryear?
So, like, it would have to be dirt cheap, right? So what the advantage of these newer things does is it allows you to connect them to newer displays and use newer input devices. If you had a actual original Amiga hardware, it's a pain in the ass just to connect it to a new display, you know, because they have a 15 kilohertz output and it's analog and yada, yada, yada. It's not easy to get a nice picture on a modern display. The flip side is you can take a $30 Raspberry Pi and make an awesome emulated Amiga. It's software emulated. Yeah. It's not cycle correct. You can notice a difference. It's not perfect, but it's damn good and it's cheap. So it's really just a passion strictly for nostalgia's sake, in my opinion. Nobody's getting any real work done on these machines. I'm sure some nerds might come out and attack me for saying that. Some people might still use it for maybe some video or audio kind of stuff, but nobody's doing any real development work on these things. It's strictly for nostalgia and fun and to keep the platform alive and breathing. So if they did an ASIC, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they'd even make the money back. Let's put it that way. You know? Yeah. So who knows? Yeah. I would love to see it, but who knows what happens.
I'm throwing a link in the chat right now. You did a Commodore 64 and a Raspberry Pi. Did you do an Amiga and a Raspberry Pi too?
I did, and it was one of the busiest articles we posted that year.
we have to dig that link up too. Where's the Raspberry Pi Amiga? Anyways.
I'll throw it in the chat. I'm sure I can find it.
Oh, there it is. There it is. It's an Amiga emulator. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Let's throw that in there. Cool. Now this is neat stuff, and I think it's always good to pay homage to the ones that started it off, this computing revolution that we're all on right now, that we're all enjoying, where you have essentially a supercomputer in your pocket. You can thank these guys at Commodore and everywhere else. What was that Netflix series or AMC series that we were watching for a while now?
Halt and Catch Fire.
Halt and Catch Fire, man. Those were great days.
Watch Halt and Catch Fire if you haven't seen it. Awesome.
You should check that out. Great, great series. Yeah. Back in the early days of computing, when they were basically coding things like Space Invaders on monochrome. You know, they were creating. Creating the games and the computing world we now live in all started back in those glorious 80s. But that about wraps up. We're going to be working on some giveaways coming up, Marco. I don't know if we want to say anything about it yet. Is it a little too soon for that?
Yeah, let's wait until we have stuff in hand. We're going to have a small giveaway, and we might do it on the podcast where we have a handful of components for some folks. We haven't pulled together stuff for a system yet, but we really got to get on that with the holidays coming. So we'll figure something out.
Think upping your network game. That's a possibility. And we'll be giving away some hardware in the weeks ahead. So stay tuned, and hopefully we'll be back on Wednesday. I think next week you're traveling, so we're not going to be doing
I'll be out of town. So unless you go with Chris, I am in California. So
okay. When do you get back? Maybe we go like Friday or something next week. But
I'm back Wednesday night, so I can go later in the week.
Okay, maybe we'll do later in the week next week, but we're trying to get back on the Wednesday cycle again. Sometimes business does not allow us to do it. Wednesdays at 5:30 is our typical time slot where you can find us here. 2.5 Geeks, hothardware.com on the web, where you should definitely check us out. Thumbs up and subscribe if you like this this little podcast episode and others. And join us twitter.com/hothardware, youtube.com/hothardvids or hothardware. And Facebook, we're everywhere, and we would love to chat with you. I'm Dave Altavilla. That was Marco Cipetta. And thanks, everybody, for stopping by.